You seem to be in a pretty dark place when you created WTF. Can you sketch out where you were in your life just then?
Sure. I had been fired for the third time from a political talk radio / internet outlet. And my career as a comic was pretty dried up. I was in the middle of a divorce. I was broke. And I really just didn't feel like I had many options. I'd run out of choices. I was incredibly depressed. I was emotionally depleted. And I was going broke rather rapidly.
So things had really bottomed out. I mean, had they gotten so bad that you were dealing with suicidal thoughts?
Yes, that is true. I do say that. Yeah, I did think about suicide a lot. I'm not sure I wanted to kill myself, but I did find it relaxing to know that I could if I had to. It's sort of the spiritual reprieve of the faithless. But I was consumed with there's a certain pride to perceiving yourself as a failure after 25 years of doing stand-up, and then having worked a bit in radio, and then tried some other venture. The last thing I did for that company was destined to fail, but I needed the money to get out of the divorce. And when they went bankrupt for a third time, I just didn't see a way out. My management had given up on me, the management I was with at the time, and the gigs weren't coming in. And, even though I had done a lot of television and I was pretty respected, I didn't see any way out. I didn't see any way forward.
I'm curious about something you just said, sort of there's a certain pride in failure. And I wonder if this is a particular vision that a comic might have.
Well, I don't know that I said that there's a pride in failure, but there's a pride in that, when you dedicate your life to something and it's something a little bit off the beaten track or something risky, when you've done it for 20 years or 25 years and it's not working out, I mean, how do you quit that? I mean, what's your next move? I mean, the last job I had that could be called a job, I worked at a restaurant in college and shortly after that. So where do you go from there? I mean, in my mind, was I going to try to be a teacher? Was I going to go to law school? Those plan Bs had long faded. So... And the idea of quitting and just disappearing or running into people and them saying, well, what have you been up to? I'm like, I just got a job. I couldn't handle it.
Yeah. Now, you had a reputation among your fellow comics as being an angry guy, a guy with an axe to grind, which had to make you wonder why these same comedians from your past would want to sit down and talk with you.
Well... comics are a unique bunch of people. We're all sort of misfits and social outcasts and awkward and self-involved. I mean, it takes a certain disposition to get into comedy. And I think that emotionally we share a lot of things. Some of us are angry. Some of us are depressed. Some of us are, addictive personalities. Some of us are just megalomaniacal. But it's all sort of the same wheelhouse. And... I think that once the podcast started going, they realized that they could have an honest conversation about who they are and what they do. And I think that was attractive to comics. And I think that despite the fact I was angry, a lot of them knew me and a lot of them understood where I was at and had some respect for me.
And we should point out, these comics are sitting down with you in your garage.
Yes.
Is there something magical about the garage?
It's starting to seem that way, isn't it, Steve?
I mean, this is not a fancy garage, is it?
Well, no. It's kind of this beat-up garage out back. It's a single-car garage. I mean, the house was built in probably 1924. And, I put a floor in there, and all my books are out there. It's pretty cozy. It's something I've always wanted. I wanted it to become what it is, not necessarily a studio, but... kind of like I guess they'd call it a man cave. It's a museum dedicated to the history of me, and all my stuff is out there. All of my books going back to childhood, pictures, posters, pieces of memorabilia from my life. So I'm pretty comfortable out there. And once I set up an actual table to put the mics and the equipment on, it definitely now feels like it has a purpose, as opposed to just me sitting out there in some, you know, drowning in nostalgia of self. So, you know, there's a magic quality to it. It's pretty cozy.
Well, and I mean, the thing that's so remarkable about your podcast is the intimacy that you develop with some pretty famous people. I mean, that they are willing to reveal what they do. And I guess I'm wondering how you make that happen. And I mean, obviously, there's something about what you do. And maybe there's also something about the place where you're doing these interviews.
Well, as I said, you know, we're all comics, most of us. And there really is a strange emotional understanding that I know we have, and I think we all sort of understand that we have. And so on some level, I'm connected to these people. And also, because over the last couple of years, I've had a tremendous amount of emotional upheaval, and I had a lot to rebuild personally, that I was really talking about myself a lot to these people that I was interviewing. And I think that creates a type of intimacy. I was never really looking to interview people. I was looking to talk to people. I think if you listen to the arc of the podcast, I needed a certain amount of help and support. And I did that in the guise of interviews. So what comes out of that is just genuine conversation about any number of things. I've always felt that comedians were philosophers and poets and social critics and have a lot more time than other people to think about things and are always looking for angles on things. And they have a lot to say about life. So it wasn't really about the joke or what movie they were in or what TV project they had coming up. It was sort of capturing through conversation who that person is and was and where they're at now and how they deal with stuff.
Now, the episode that really put you on the map was your conversation with Robin Williams. And this was not the usual Robin Williams that we've heard, sort of that, you know, hyperdrive manic Robin Williams. He was actually pretty laid back and real. Can you tell me about that interview?
Well, you know, he's a pretty sweet guy when you hang around. He was always oddly fairly accessible when you run into him at a comedy club or something. And you sit and chat with him. If there's not too many people around, he's almost shy and very sweet. And I think that once he agreed to do it, you know, I drove up to his place up in the Bay Area. It was 11 in the morning. It was at his home. There was no one there. It was just the two of us with two microphones. And I don't think that there was anyone really to perform for. And I think he was at a point in his life where he'd had a relapse on alcohol. He'd had heart surgery. You know, he was looking at some darkness. And, you know, he'd gone through a divorce. And there was a vulnerability there that I certainly understood. And I think that he was ready to talk about and to talk about it in a candid way.
So it almost sounds like you've created a space where some of these people can reveal something that they can't reveal anywhere else. I mean, so, you know, they're difficult stuff.
Yeah, I don't. That doesn't happen all the time, but it does happen some of the time. And I don't know that is always the intention. Sometimes it just happens. Sometimes I'm surprised by what happens. And my concern was that, you know, I don't want the podcast to be known for necessarily, you know, taking people into the depths of their emotional darkness, because there's a lot of interviews I do that when I have a conversation with somebody, I kind of figure out where they're at and how to talk to them. And some are easier than others, but if we're not going to go there, we're not going to go there. So let's just have a fun conversation. I mean, that I can do that too.
You know, well, and there's another kind of conversation that you sometimes have where you start out apologizing to your guest because maybe you had trouble with this person in the past, and you sort of, you know, are upfront about it. You're kind of laying it all out there.
Well, I have to do that. I don't know. A lot of times when I do that, there are a lot of people that I've had problems with in the past, but it turns out that a lot of those problems may be just my side of it. I mean, when you're self-involved or a bit narcissistic and you're looking at your life as, you know, you're some sort of hero or anti-hero walking through it, having this profound effect on everybody that comes in contact with you, you know, things that I hold on to or think that I've done, you know, lines I have crossed, sometimes resonate more with me than with the person I'm talking to. But yeah, there generally is, and I think I've gotten through a lot of them. There's a lot of people that I felt like I owed apologies for, but you have to understand that sometimes I will hold on to one meeting, you know, that happened 15 years ago that I still remember as me being a bastard of some kind. And sometimes people remember it, sometimes they don't. But there are deeper difficulties. I mean, like with me and Louis C.K.
I was going to ask about that.
Well, that was a strained relationship for a long time. You know, I love the guy.
And you go way back to him. I mean, you both sort of started out as comics together, right?
Yeah. I've known him a long time. And I always had a pretty deep emotional connection to him and I think he to me. And we always were able to sort of lock in when necessary and walk each other through things. But we sort of lost touch, and my envy got the best of me, and we just didn't talk to each other, and it was difficult. So when I did those interviews, that was some pretty real stuff to try to kind of navigate and renegotiate a friendship to try to save a friendship.
And what do you do with something like that? I mean, he has this huge career now. You know, way more successful than you've been, and I mean, you got to feel resentful, or it would be very natural. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, well, of course it's natural, but then, you know, there's certain. How do you want to live your life? You know, I mean, look, I've been fueled by resentment a good part of my life, and it doesn't yield much, and you end up alone and isolated in a sort of righteous bitterness. You know, and bitterness really. At the core is just amplified self-pity. So ultimately, if you can't at least pretend that you're happy for your friends, you know, you're not going to have too many after all is said and done. I've always been impressed with Louis' talent. And certainly, I've always said that out of all the people I know, he is really the only one capable of executing a work of genius. And I said this years ago when he was making movies, and I always knew that. But the other issue is, how much attention do you need, you know, as a person? You know, how much attention, emotional attention, do I need from a quote-unquote friend? And then you have to sort of ask yourself, well, are my needs a little too much? I mean, this guy's busy. He's got two kids. You know, he's got a divorce on his hands. He's, you know, juggling all these things, producing his own shows. Do I really have to, you know, do I really need him to pay attention to maybe a mundane problem? Or do I need to know that we're still pals? Or every week, you know, it really becomes an examination of self. But yeah, resentment is obviously natural, but at some point you have to realize that anyone else's success is not about you. It's not at you. It really has nothing to do with you. And to make it about you is selfish.
And he called you out on some of this stuff, right? I mean, you know, basically saying you were jealous of him. You know, you weren't there when he actually could have used your friendship.
Yeah, that was, you know, he brought up something that I didn't really remember, and it was a good call. You know, I mean, I decided that I just couldn't, because I needed things too from a friend, you know. I mean, friends need things from each other. And if you're emotionally crazy like me and you know, you're like Louis, I think there was a point where I didn't feel like I was getting attention from him and I was jealous of his success. So I just said, look, you know, it's causing me difficulty to try to communicate with this guy because it's just not that important to him. So I'm not going to. And I, you know, I just cut him off. I'd forgotten about that. It's interesting what you forget about.
The powers of repression.
That's right. But yeah, he did call me out on that, and I let that moment sit, And that episode had a lot of effect on people. A lot of emails came in about, you know, from people that had friendships that had gone bad and or gone unattended and got lost. And I think it helped some people.
Now, there was another interview you did that got a lot of traction with Carlos Mencia, who had a reputation as a joke stealer, and you confronted him about that, and somehow it seemed to work out okay in the end.
Well, you know, it's an interesting story about those two episodes is that when I brought Carlos in, I'm not that big a gossip, and I don't get caught up much in the social politics of my business. Because comics can be, it's like high school, man, and comics are just, you know, can be so catty and so awful. But I guess everybody can. But I didn't really know the full story. So when I brought Carlos in, all I knew was that, you know, years ago, this video that, you know, Joe Rogan and his people put out of, you know, of a confrontation that he had with Carlos at the Comedy Store, you know, really vilified Carlos in almost an international way because of the nature of viral technology. So, you know, I had my own thoughts on the issue. And when I brought him in for the first interview, it was not to confront him that deeply on stealing. It was to really talk to him about what it felt like to be such a pariah, to be so hated, and to, you know, talk to him about whether he felt he deserved it or not. So my angle was not to interrogate him that first interview. It was to get a sense of where he was at, call him out on a couple of the more known incidents of stealing, and just see where he was at. And then what happened was he just steamrolled me, and I could tell he was trying to use my podcast to rebuild his reputation. And it was very political and planned on his part, and it really aggravated me. So I wasn't even going to use the interview, but the problem was that I'd already tweeted that I was doing it. So people were like, where's the interview? And I'm like, I can't release this because I didn't get to the issue. And then I talked to some other comics, and they're like, dude, you don't even know the scope of this thing. You know, my friend Al Madrigal said, you got to talk to Latino guys and find out where this guy comes from. So that's how the second episode came along. Was I talked to a couple of the Latino comics, one who started out with Carlos and another one who opened for him for years, and you know a different picture was evolving. So I had to call Carlos and say, "Look, you know, I got to ask you some other questions about specific incidents. We can do it on the phone." And he's like, "No, bro, I'll come over now. I just landed at LAX. I'm coming over." And he came over in an hour, and I didn't know him. I didn't know what he was capable of. I didn't know if he traveled with people. I didn't know how ugly it would get. So that second interview is that. It's him sitting down. And I think ultimately, if you listen to it, you will hear who that guy is as a person. You will completely understand his psychology. It will become clear to you for your own personal interpretation of whether he did steal or not.
But he kind of admits that he did, doesn't he?
He doesn't flat out say, yeah, I did. You know, he says, if I did. There's enough there for you to make a case for yourself, but also, more importantly, to see that guy as a person. And I find that's what happens a lot on the podcast, is that, you know, because some of these people are celebrities, the way we all interact with celebrities is that either we idolize them because they're stars of some kind, or we're fascinated and obsessed in a sordid way because of tabloids or controversy. So when you sit down with someone for an hour, really, unless they're very insulated, you will see them as a person.
Now, do you think that appearance, I mean, doing that podcast with you has helped Carlos Mencia's career? Has it kind of taken away that pariah label?
No, I don't know that it has done that. I don't know really if it did anything other than, you know, introduce him to a lot of people that probably hated him as a person. You know, you can whether you think he's guilty of these things or not, that's still going to be for you to decide. But, you know, when you listen to him, he's got other problems, man. So So I think it might have put him in perspective. I don't know really what it did one way or the other, career-wise or reputation-wise.
Now, it almost sounds like some of these podcasts are kind of function like therapy. You know, people getting stuff off their chest and for some reason telling it to the world, at least those people who follow you, gets rid of something out of their deep black box.
Sometimes. Sometimes. There have been times where people come to it with different expectations. Some people are willing to talk. Some people want to talk. But a lot of times, like I said, these are thoughtful people. The Todd Hanson episode around this type of conversation that you and I are having was really the most profound as an event. And I think a lot of times...
Tell me about that.
Well, you know, Todd Hanson was really the original head writer of The Onion for most practical purposes. He was there at the ground floor, you know, comes from up in your area.
Right.
The original Onion crew. And he was with The Onion when they moved to New York. And he was there in a very big way when The Onion blew up, you know, on an international level. And I'd known him for years, and I'd always liked him. We didn't talk much, but, like, we were all in the same circle. And I had scheduled an interview with him in New York. I was there for a few days doing a live WTF in Brooklyn. And I said, look, let's do an interview. Let's do this. Why don't you meet me at my hotel? So Todd comes over to the hotel, and he basically says, yeah, I've been to this hotel before. And this is off mic. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, I came here, and I checked in. And I had no intention of checking out. So off mic, you know, I'd known he'd had depression, but I did not know that he had attempted suicide. And by coincidence, I think, you know, it was at this hotel I was staying at. And I guess he had talked to his therapist about, you know, going back to the hotel, and he had decided that, you know, it was good. I'm the right guy to be there for this moment for him. To be back at that place where he intended to kill himself and tried. And we talked about it off mic, and I said, well, what are we going to do here? Are we going to talk about this, or what do you want to do? And he goes, I don't know. So we did the interview, and we talked for an hour about The Onion, about its impact, about, you know, where it came from, where he came from. And at the end, he just said, look, maybe we have more to talk about another time, but I really appreciate, you know, whatever he said. I'm paraphrasing. So that was the end of that interview. And I just kind of held on to it. I said, look, you know, if you want to talk about this, the other thing, we can do a second part to this. And he's like, okay, I'll think about it. So I didn't put up that first interview. I just held on to it. And a few months later, you know, he said, I think I can talk about it. So I said, okay. So I met him at his apartment, and he, you know, he walked me through that day and those feelings and the repercussions of taking that action and how it affected him and others and how he felt now. And I posted those two together. And that had a profound effect on me, on hundreds and hundreds of listeners who sent emails, who had dealt with that, those feelings themselves, or had family members that they could never understand how that family member could do that or try to do that. And it just shed a lot of light in a very intimate way on a profound, horrible human reality that is completely selfish and mysterious to people that don't have those kind of feelings.
Have you talked with Todd about that since then? I mean, do you have any sense of
what
doing that podcast has meant to him?
I think it was great for him. You know, after we did that, he was very obsessed with, you know, he wanted to hear it before it went out. And I'll honor anybody's request to either take something out or not post a show. So we got it into a form that he was comfortable with. We really didn't take anything out. And, you know, I just started forwarding him the feedback that I was getting through the website, you know, just like hundreds of emails. And I think it had a profound effect on him. I think it was it was sort of purging. You know, I think he felt like he helped people, which is important for people that are consumed with depression and that type of self-involvement. And he seems okay. The one thing you don't know about depressives is you don't. It's not like he's all better, but he's okay. I just saw him a couple weeks ago.
Now, the stereotype, of course, of comics is that their humor comes out of their insecurities, their neuroses. And it sounds like, from what you're saying, that it's basically true.
Sometimes. Sometimes you can't quite find them. And I over time, I've really shifted my attitudes about how I feel about stand-up, you know, what my values are around other stand-ups, and also the sort of stereotype of what comics are. By and large, it does come from some sort of compulsion or insecurity, not necessarily darkness, not necessarily damage, sometimes just compulsion and an ability to be funny. But I think the stereotype holds for the most part, but I have met a few well-adjusted comedians who are funny. So I can't.
That species does exist there.
It does, yeah.
No, we started out by talking about where you were when you first created WTF. I mean, you know, your life was a wreck at that point, and things have totally changed. I mean, the podcast is a huge hit. You do a lot of stand-up comedy. I know you've had negotiations about a TV show. Is it fair to say that comedy has saved your life again?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It saved my life in a very unusual way, in that I did it. No one, you know, gave me an opportunity. No one, you know, hung any sort of expectation on me. No one said, well, we're going to run this guy up the pole and see if anyone takes. Like, it was not, I'm the top of the food chain here. So, and coming from a guy who, yeah, I never was business minded. You know, all I wanted to do was be a great stand up. I never had any sense of running a business or even taking my own risks like that. I always worked for somebody. There was a lot of money being thrown around in show business one way or the other for a lot of nothing. And you always wanted to get some of that money. You know, give me a couple $100,000 to maybe do something. But that feels pretty empty after a while, and that didn't happen much for me, maybe once in my life, you know, many years ago. But the fact that we took this opportunity based on a new medium and based on the fact that I knew a couple of dudes were doing this, and we tried it. And the guy I was working with, my producer, when we left the place where we were working, they didn't kick us out of our office for a month, and they didn't take away our security cards. So, you know, we were like, well, we got a studio, let's start using it. So we were, you know, kind of breaking in after hours, and we did these things, and we just made a couple of agreements with each other. We said, we've got to, you know, do this, you know, like clockwork, twice a week, and we just got to stay consistent and let the show evolve, but we got to do it twice a week. And that's all we really knew. We didn't know that it was going to be an interview show. We didn't know how, you know, comics were going to continue to be included. We just had no idea of anything other than got to do it twice a week, and that's not negotiable. And then this thing happened, and we've had to learn how to kind of wrangle what's becoming a small business and booking people and you know, staying on top of it and keeping it vital and figure out how to evolve the show. So the reward of doing something on your own, because you think stand up like, hey, you guys, you just get up there, man. It's all you. It's not really all us. It is to a degree, but you got to, you know, sell tickets. You've got to build relationships with club owners, with booking people. There's a lot to be done to be a successful comic. It doesn't happen overnight. It's hard to maintain. And there's really a lot of other people involved because you're in the business of selling tickets or selling drinks. So, and then if you're on TV, then there's God knows how many people involved, and you have very little control in the big picture, unless you're Louis. But that was said with love. So, so the fact that this happened like that, and that, you know, the pride that comes from creating something successful, really with your own hands and your own mind, and taking some risks and earning a little money from it is something I never have experienced before, and it feels I'm very grateful for it, but it just to feel like you've earned your money and that you've earned your success is something I never thought I would feel, you know, just by virtue of how my brain is built. Hmm. But it's, you know, there's no one to blame here. Even if I think that things aren't going the way I want them, yeah, I just shut up now because it's it's no longer about me. You know, like if I do an interview and I'm like, you know, I didn't get my emotional needs met on that interview. It's like, well, you know, it's really not about that to everybody else. You know, they people, you know, I can't, you know, say like, you know, that interview was okay. I didn't feel like it went great because I'm talking to somebody that people love or that they have, that they're curious about. It's not all about me, you know, and to have that experience of just a little bit of selflessness and to know that my show is affecting people on a deep level and helping people, I it's more than I could ever ask for. And it just blows my mind because I was washed up, buddy. And that's a reality.
Hmm. So given what you've been through over the last, 5 years or so, I'm wondering if you have any advice for people, comic or not, whose life has bottomed out about how to climb out of that pit.
Well, I knew, you know, and I'm in a different position than a lot of people because of whoever I am and whatever problems I have. You know, I am 2 divorces into life. I have no children. So the dependent issue was a lot less than a lot of other people who are having trouble and they have certain responsibilities. But I do know that you have to fight through that pride and through that sense of failure. You have to somehow manage to get past that cycle of self-criticism and self-abuse for whatever you think went wrong in your life and put it aside and try to do what's in front of you and do whatever you have to do to live your life and to get back up on some sort of level ground. And I know it's hard for people right now. My brother is a great example, is having a tremendous amount of difficulty because of the market, because of jobs. He's got a large family. And, you know, I don't really know what to say to him other than it's happening to a lot of people. And we all had expectations about how our life was going to turn out or how we wanted it to turn out or what we were entitled to. But a lot of that isn't happening for a lot of people. And it's really not their fault. And you just have to adapt to what's going on right now for you and for the country and just realize that you can be disappointed, but what's important is that you're alive, you're healthy, you got people that love you and depend on you, is to not ruin all that because you think you failed. Because that's the stuff that's going to get you through this.